Hey, I'm Ariel Waldman. Welcome back to Offworld, where we talk about all things space and pop culture. This week, we're actually not talking about a specific film, but we're talking about the trope of isolation. You see it in science fiction, you see it in reality, you see it kind of everywhere when it comes to space. So let's jump in. So today we're joined by Andre Viscontas, a neuroscientist, opera singer, and co-host of Science and Progress on Tested.com, and Mika McKinnon, a field geophysicist, sci-fi science consultant, and science writer. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we're talking about isolation, which is a trope that comes up so often in space science fiction and space reality. So you have, the Martian, where, he's sort of shipwrecked on Mars, gravity, she's kind of shipwrecked in low Earth orbit. We have, explorers, Star Trek. We've got truckers like The Expanse, all these different things in science fiction, but also we've got, our own history, Apollo and being on the moon, being isolated there, and future human space flight, where hopefully one day, before too long, astronauts will be going to Mars and they're going to be pretty isolated. So, getting right into the heart of it, in a lot of science fiction, we see depictions of coping mechanisms in isolation. So in WALL-E, you see humans who are kind of being distracted, watching TV and shopping and being really passive. But in films like like Moon, you see people, or you see the main character gardening and doing clay modeling, something more interactive. Are some coping mechanisms better than others?
Well, I can speak to what we actually do in the field. So during field work, you end up in these funny little isolated areas where your entire community is in one tiny place, and often it's difficult to communicate out. You can have, sometimes you have internet, sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's only satellite phones, sometimes it's only once a week shopping runs via helicopter. And anything that you are doing to entertain yourself, you have to bring with you. So if you've got all the space and time in the world, you bring everything with you and have infinite entertainment. But often you're limited by space, by quantity, by volume, and so you end up with like the one USB key of music that you just pass around the entire camp, and everybody gets to know each other's music because it's all you have. So you just try and entertain yourself with what it is you've managed to bring with you and what resources you have available.
Yeah, and I think there's like two issues here too. First is just like how do you pass time, right? Like how do you fight boredom in these kinds of situations? But then also, how do you account for the fact that our brains have evolved in a social environment? And in fact, a lot of the differences between human brains and other primate brains really come from the fact that we have to get along. So, part of it is also making you feel less alone. So I think that some of these, watching TV, listening to the radio, I know a lot of people who, even if they live alone, just have the radio on all the time because it feels like there are people around, right?
I usually keep the television on all the time, even muted sometimes, just to feel not so alone. So that's, are those is there research or is there anything that points to, at least a virtual socialness as being helpful in
You know,
isolation?
I think that's still relatively new, and I don't know how. I mean, there's definitely research showing that sometimes it can make you feel more alone, but feeling useful is actually really helpful. Like, so one of the things I loved about the movie Moon is that he's gardening. He's actually taking care of plants. And it turns out that if you are in a nursing home and you actually will add months to your life if someone gives you a plant to take care of. So it's a sense that you are actually useful, that you are needed.
So plants are really, really, really popular in space. So there was this big to-do when Scott Kelly had the first flower in space. It turned out it wasn't the first flower by like 30 years. But, he was very excited because it was his first flower in space. And so I went into this like research hole, digging up through all these times where people have been gardening in space. And one of them was this illicit zucchini flower they brought in their personal gear, and they grew the zucchini flower, and then they'd trade and make other astronauts do their least favorite chores in return for having quality alone time sniffing the flower. So they get like private time with the zucchini flower. So the gardening is definitely, it's one of the more popular chores, and it's this concept of like you can nurture and bring life in. I've definitely had a couple of field camps where when we were there for long enough, we would start developing like a little flower garden path, not normally anything useful, always decorative and just kind of a little bit frivolous and fun, and then like a bear would eat it, but we'd try.
Don't have to worry about that in space so much. Exactly. Like, space bears might, you know.
but you can't bring a hamster up, which, you know.
Don't bring not yet, small, anyway. Like, things that will chew on your cables.
Right. So I think that there's, like, a sense of, like, growing something, watching it build that is more active and in that way more satisfying than just passively watching TV.
Yeah, well, I mean, we also talked about music and getting sick of other people's music, our own music, the idea of limited music. But, you know, in a lot of films, we also see people singing to themselves. So in Gravity, she starts kind of singing to herself along with some guy on ham radio or something. We see in Moon, I think he's singing to himself a little bit. The Martian, definitely. You know, are there any benefits to making your own music, you know, cognitively or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's a tough question for me to answer sort of empirically, but just, you know, from what I know of the research about music in general is that, yes, it's about social connections, right? It's about making connections with others. And I think it also just helps you pass the time. It just, time feels like it goes by faster if you have your own soundtrack. But I agree with you that listening to music, listening to the exact same sound, you know, scape actually gets really boring after a while because you can't extract more meaning to it. But if you're creating it yourself, then you can always alter it a little bit. You can, you know, the acoustics, you can play with the acoustics. There's just like little things that you can do that keep it interesting.
So there is some element of repetition. There was a chunk of research that I got really excited by, which is when you experience the same story over and over again. So read the same book, watch the same episodes of the TV show, anything like that, that your brain does not necessarily remember that they're fictional on an emotional level. And so they have these emotional connections. So it's like hanging out with your friends and having that sort of self-soothing going on. And because you have already done it before, you already know what the ending is. So there's none of that anticipation stress or the uncertainty or the, I don't know how this social interaction is going to unfold. You go into it knowing exactly what you're going to get out. So it ends up being this element of, you've just had a day, everything went wrong, your equipment wasn't working, whatever, but you can settle down at the end of the day and do something extremely predictable with a known emotional outcome and can use that as a way of calming yourself down, grounding yourself, and having that end of the day still reset, no matter how chaotic your actual work day was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, another example I remember actually is, you know, from reality, I think there's a video of astronauts on the moon from Apollo 17, and they're singing, just two of them bouncing around on the moon, just like singing a song, like having a great time. And it certainly feels as if, you know, it's helping them sort of be lighthearted about the fact that they're kind of all there by themselves. And another thing, you know, we see often in reality, is in isolation, in space, is exercise, partially because of necessity. You know, mm-hmm. the astronauts aboard the International Space Station have to exercise like 2.5 hours a day just to maintain sort of, you know, some baseline health. But you do actually see it depicted a ton in science fiction as well. You have 2001, he's running around, mm-hmm. Europa Report, they're doing a lot of exercise. Are there, you know, is exercise, is it really just about only like the physical health, or like, you know, with your remote work that you've done as a geophysicist, mm-hmm. is there a benefit to doing exercise that really helps psychologically?
Yeah, so this is, again, we can see this in real life in terms of anyone who does deployments, there are a certain amount of patterns that you do, like you do your morning run if you're on a military deployment, or whatever your exercise pattern of that day is. And yes, it helps maintain your physical fitness so you can do the hardship, because working in remote and extreme environments is physically very, very hard, and space is an extremely hard environment to live in. But it's also, you get the endorphin from it, you get the pattern from it, you get to set your schedule of your day and have some structure, which anytime you're working in an uncontrolled environment, anytime you're doing field work, and space is extreme field work, you're going to be faced with an infinite number of things that are going to go outside of plan. We see this all the time during spacewalks. I mean, they've had freaking water seep into their helmets during spacewalks. Like, you have all sorts of things that go outside of plan that you need to deal with and cope with those problems and adapt along the way. So having some set things that are normal, some set things that are patterns, some ways that you start the day like this and you end the day like this and all the chaos is contained in between helps maintain a little bit of balance and lets your brain kind of warm up and shut down without having to constantly problem solve.
I also think that there's another element too, which is your circadian rhythm, which is often disrupted in these kinds of environments where, you know, you don't have a regular day-night cycle. And left to your own devices, you actually have, most people have a circadian rhythm pattern that is about 25 hours that needs to get reset every day. So that when the sun rises or they get that cue, that actually resets their rhythm for the day. So in the one thing that can help sort of set that is not just, you know, some artificial light turning on and off, but also exercise, because it can make you feel more tired at the end of the day, which makes it more likely that you can fall asleep. And so I think that that's something, you know, too, that we often underestimate is the power of exercise to help you sleep.
Yeah, that's, I mean, a good point about, you know, the sun and rising with the sun. I know on the International Space Station, they've really battled a lot with blue light being on the ISS. It's really been problematic for keeping that rhythm. They've sort of had to battle against it. And yeah, so exercise might be like a good way of like coping with the fact that, you know, you might not even be seeing your own star from your solar system, depending on how far away you are. Yeah.
And windows won't help, because things like the International Space Station has 15 sunrises and sunsets a day. It's all the time. And I mean, that's the opposite problem in the north. We have, you know, suddenly we have 20 hours of daylight or 4 hours of daylight, depending when we're doing our work. But either which way around it, you can't use your light as your cues. So the space station has the many sunrises and sunsets, and they have all the pink lights everywhere. This is something I don't see as much in sci-fi that I'd really like to see more, is all the interior lighting that you have to change around for the poor little humans who are squishy and fragile and confused by not being near their sun, but also for the various plants. What exactly do you need in terms of wavelengths in order to grow them? So on the space station, they're using a lot of magenta light, so they can do just the wavelengths necessary to make these plants grow at their peak. I'd love to see that more in sci-fi.
Yeah, that's a great point, because, you know, often in science fiction, you get either completely overwhelming bright white light, or you have like mood lighting, like in Stargate Universe, where it's just like, oh, this is like a nice like nightclub or something. Yeah, yes. No, that'd be great. So totally kind of pivoting to a new question, and this might be a more future-facing question, is, you know, so another sort of trope in isolation in science fiction, at least, or actually I guess this plays out in reality as well, is someone by themselves experiences something weird in space. So in Contact, you have the main character, she has a profound, almost psychedelic sort of experience, comes back. No one believes her. We've had astronauts go into space, see things that they couldn't explain very well, come back, and everyone's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Is it even, you know, is there any research being done or efforts being made to sort of be able to share subjective memories with other humans? Like something, you know, this is like a slightly out there question, but, you know, are we capable of sort of reading other people's memories? Or are we on that path at all, or is that still way science fiction?
Yeah, so this is something actually that I had that kind of bothered me about any of these science fiction movies where there are clones involved and where they, you know, use memories to sort of keep the clones in check, so like Oblivion or Moon. And I want to talk about that in a minute, but first I'll say is that it's actually not uncommon or even unexpected to hallucinate when you're alone. So there's lots of studies of showing that when you put people in solitary confinement and you reduce the sensory input that they have, their brains in a few days will start making up sensory input. So hallucinations are a natural consequence of being isolated.
I talk to myself a lot when I'm working alone, and admittedly, there's this much of it is make enough noise the bears don't eat me, but a large chunk of it is if I say everything out loud, I keep on track as to what I'm doing, I remember what I'm doing, and I don't have a TV to leave on like a dog at home to, you know, not be alone, so I have to use my own voice to convince myself I'm not alone. So I have like this beautiful, spectacular wilderness out on a glacier all by my lonesome, nobody around for kilometers and kilometers, and I will shatter to myself the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, our brains have evolved to detect change. And when there's no change in the environment, the brain starts to make it, you know, and we start to see and hear things. But the other side of your question, which is about this collective memory idea or how you can share memories. So, you know, one of the things that really bothers me about these kind of clone movies is that they assume that you can grow a clone in a vat. Mm-hmm. You can take the clone out of the vat and they are a fully functioning human brain, which is so contradictory to how we actually know how the brain works. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, like, you know, is artificial intelligence ever going to be conscious? Can you program consciousness into AI? And my answer is, if you give it experience, because consciousness emerges from experience. Mm-hmm. So memories emerge from experience. So none of these clones would be able to see or hear or do any of the things that they can do if they weren't interacting.
Like,
watch a baby, you know, develop and grow. And even, like, you know, when they turn 3 or 4, or, you know, when they start discovering that they are themselves an entity that is separate from those around them, like, that's a real discovery for them that has to come with interacting with the world. So, you know, that's what bothers me. It's like, you can't just assume that even if the brain is 100% identical, if it hasn't had those experiences, it's not going to have those memories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in answer to your question, like, can we share these memories? You know, the answer really is like, you know, can you share some element of the experience? So I think the way that you would do it is somehow have like a kind of virtual reality thing where you put the person back into that same situation and see if they have that same experience. But, you know, memories are so overrepresented in the brain in so many different ways. You know, we think about memories as, oh, it's just like, you know, there's a file that you write down and then you put it into file drawer. And then when you want to grab it, you grab the file.
Simple.
Right? Totally simple. It's not at all how it works. And that's not actually what we evolved remembering so that we can predict the future, so that we can take elements of our past and then figure out what the consequences might be of something in the future. So every time we remember, we have to physically reconstruct the memory. Even on the in the form of like how those neurons are activated. So, you know, can you physically reconstruct that activation pattern in someone else's brain? Yes. Is it going to be the same memory? No, because that person's neurons have, you know.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that points more towards, you know, don't send people into space completely by themselves. Make sure that they share an experience with other people. But I guess I actually in the book Contact, you know, she doesn't go alone. She's with a group of people and the whole group is not believed. So I guess that's still like, you know, flaky a bit. But, you know, going into the group side of isolation, I guess, you know, governance and justice is like a thing that comes up a lot. I know in your field work it's come up, but you know, you see it in Stargate Universe and a lot of other things where people, you have a lot of infighting. You know, how do you establish governance or justice with an isolated team?
So I've definitely found that both in reality and in fiction, humans are really inclined towards in-group, out-group, and we will create them in any possible way. And we'll create in-group, out-group by gender, by job, by sports team, by place of origin, by shoe color. Like, we will find something and latch onto it and create divisions and go, this is us, and that is them, and us are good and them are bad. And it will happen everywhere, time and time again. And if you have a really good field camp where your leadership is extremely experienced and cares to intervene, you can manage to set it up so that the in-group is all the squishy little fragile humans, and the out-group is the hostile universe where there be dragons and bears. And if you can get that, then you have really cool group cohesion and you can do a whole bunch of things inside of it. But it is so rare. I think I've had it happen in 3 or 4 camps total.
So what are some of, you know, the power plays or ways in which, you know, you're isolated, you have limited resources anyway. There's only so much to gain, it sort of seems like. You know, what are some of the power plays that you see emerge from teams?
There are always the worst chores and the better chores. or no chores at all, just like the astronauts and trading off the least favorite chore for sniffing the zucchini flower, you end up with who gets the very, very best of the extremely bland field food, or who gets the slightly softer pillow the slightly nicer location, slightly more downtime. You don't need all that much. It's there's a whole bunch of economics research about happiness isn't having money. It's happiness is having more money than your neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's that relative comparison thing going on again. You can have that in field camp. You can have that in isolation. You can have that on the space station of you just need that little who got to decide what music was played this morning.
Yeah, and I mean, you see that in the film Passengers. You know, the some of the crew are allowed more diversity in food, and while other crew members are like, you know, it's the same thing over and over again, and some have, you know, nicer compartments than others. You know, it's, and I think, like, even in The Expanse, you see some elements of that, of you've got people who have more money than others, and yeah.
You can also get it in terms of experience. So when you're dealing with isolation, communication is huge, right? Like, if you have tiny limited lifelines back to home, wherever home is, those become extremely precious. So that could be the amount of time you get of phone calls home or emails home or whatever it is. And you see that International Space Station, or you see that on in The Martian. But it could also be going back to the shared memory idea. Stargate Universe had memory stones, where if you hold the stone, you switch consciousness with somebody on Earth, and you get that chance to, you don't have your body there, but your brain is there to interact with the people you're missing. Well, who gets to use those stones? Was this huge, constant, dramatic power play of politics and need and necessity for the group, and also just flat out power plays as to who we get that interaction.
I think actually you see a lot of this in people who are incarcerated. You know, in prisons have so many of these dynamics, like who gets to do the phone call and, you know, all the whole power play, the in-group, out-group. All of it is there in the prison system. And even in solitary confinement, where you see, you know, people who, I've been listening to this podcast named Ear Hustle. Have you guys been listening? It's great. It's about inmates in San Quentin, basically, and their lives. And they talk about, you know, going through solitary and people who have been in confinement for literally decades, and how they come back and they don't even know how to interact with other people. So, like, one of them hadn't seen his mom in, like, 15 years, and he was like, I know, finally, I was going to see my mom. And he was like, I thought for days about how I would hug her. Like, would I just put one arm around her, or, like, both arms around her, or, like, do I put it around her neck? And, like, all these little things were, like, going through their head, you know, and so you realize that, like, how quickly we can become unaccustomed to things that we, you know, find natural in these environments.
And you'll... There's this whole concept of when in military deployments, coming back, the post-deployment, there's entire support systems in place for trying to reintegrate back into normal everyday life. Fieldwork doesn't have that sort of nice structure to it, but is definitely something where I would always have, there's my field life, my field persona, the things I do there, how I entertain myself, how I stay safe, my day-to-day has very little in common with who I am when I'm around other human beings for extended periods of time. And I always needed to relearn how to do things. So I actually had a checklist where I go through and be like, so today's objectives are, I need to text three people, make a phone call, go to a coffee, talk to a stranger in a store. Like, these things I had to do to start reintegrating myself back into being a functional human being who understood how society works. And it would happen every single field job.
Yeah, I mean, that's is interesting also, that you bringing up the whole prison thing, because I know a couple of different groups have done projects with people in prisons to get them to sort of create how isolated Mars, you know, groups might work together and actually, you know, concept it out and prototype it out. And they're generating really great research and actually doing it with the people in the prison so that their names are going on to these papers as well. But so, you know, my final question, I guess, for both of you are, if you had to go on a journey to Mars, land there, come back to Earth, it's going to be, you know, let's say about 2 years long, what would be like your number one thing that you would want to make sure is there with you?
Wow.
So there's in this whole concept of isolation, knowing when you're coming back is actually really, really, really helpful. It's, I always hated doing jobs that were indeterminately long, where I'd go until the job was finished and then I got to come back, because it's really hard to plan and to wrap your head around what you need to do, because you're just trying to get through each day. So having a return date and knowing that we'd hit that return date would actually be the thing I'd want most.
Yeah.
It's so to be like, we are leaving on this
calendar
day.
Yeah.
And it's like this many days, this much time, this is how long you are here. And then you get to come back and that you're definitely coming back. Like those factors there, that's, I want that regularity. I want those patterns. I want that predictability.
Like you're not just going to be put into a pod and then incinerated the way these movies end.
You know, spoiler. Well, we won't say which film that's about.
It's not just one.
No, I know. That's true. So what would you say?
So I think I would try to bring goals that, like, things that, you know, self, you know, actualization things that I've always wanted to accomplish that I could do, you know, in a way that would take a long time but could be sort of tracked in that way. So same idea in terms of like tracking time, but you know, maybe you know, trying to memorize a whole bunch of opera roles, yeah, or like, you know, trying to learn how to visualize or meditate, or like something that is a skill that I could develop on my own time that I could actually track progress in. I think that's what I would need. Cool. It'd still be really hard. Yeah.
Well, the number of people I've taught how to knit or crochet in field right camps is kind of phenomenal. As we just strip the garbage bags out and start using sticks to do it with. An actual physical object I'd want to bring is a camera. And the purpose of that would be less scientific and less about documenting the experience as creating some distance. Is that when you can look at everything through a camera, you can temporarily go, I'm not here. I am documenting this for someone else to share them later. So you're photographing for an imaginary audience. So even if you're in total isolation, it's actually just a time-delayed isolation. And it also makes it easier to deal with things that are emotionally upsetting. That really big, like, giant face-hugger spider that was in one of my camps. Oh, I felt so much more calm about it once I was like, and here's a camera between me and you. We are the exact same distance away, and I'm going to have to hang out with you for the next 20 minutes while I do my readings. But now you're on the other side of the camera.
Yes. Well, I think my thing would, I don't know, I'd have so many different things, but I'd just go with a cat. I'm going to bring a pet cat. Anyway, thank you both so much for joining with this episode. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That was awesome. Actually, talking about all the distractions that come up in isolation was really fascinating. We talked a little bit about, you know, passive distractions and more active ones like gardening. But one thing we actually didn't end up mentioning were holodecks, which sometimes can be fairly passive, like you see in Sunshine, it being very, you know, comforting. But also there's Star Trek, where holodecks are incredibly interactive experiences. So let me know what your distraction would be if you were isolated on Mars for a couple of years. What would you want to do?